So this is Monday, February 22. Is that correct? Thank you. We're just finishing up the first handout overhead of the neurochemistry part of this semester. And we're very easily, we're looking at the last page, like I said, the first handout. And we're looking at the bottom of the first page, bottom of the last page of the first handout. And we're looking at acetylcholine. And we see here that when we look at the details of acetylcholine, we see that it's pretty straightforward. A choline is a very simple molecule. Acetylcholine, it simply has a two-carbon unit called acetate, or acetyl group, and the choline. Now, choline, do you remember anything about a phosphatidyl? Remember? It was one of the membrane components. It was a phospholipid. It was called phosphatidylcholine. Although it was interesting to hear this most recent seminar speaker, I think she called it phosphatidyl. Oh, I have no idea where she's coming from. It could be I've always heard of phosphatidyl. So, phosphatidyl, phosphatidyl. You call it tomato. I call it tomato. Doesn't matter. All right. So, choline. That's the exact same choline as in phosphatidylcholine. So it's got some carbons and a lot of nitrogens on it. Very simple, simple molecule. Honestly, you put a acetate on it. Acetyl group inside becomes acetylcholine, which is a very powerful neurotransmitter. It's amazing how very simple molecules can, in fact, have such power. So here's acetylcholine, and there's an acetylcholine synthetase that takes this acetyl groups and the cholines, and this is obviously recycled, makes it an acetylcholine, packages it in the synaptic vesicles for storage. Then, of course, when calcium comes into the region, there's a binding of this vesicle to the membrane. There's a release. Acetylcholine comes out and lands on this sodium. In this case, this is a sodium transporter. And so opens it up, and sodium comes in, initiates a potential, action potential. But what is the fate of acetylcholine? Well, acetylcholine then has a couple different fates. The primary fate is there's an enzyme called acetylcholine esterase. And that's number two right here. This is acetylcholine esterase. It exists in that compound in between the two things here, and it's designed to break down acetylcholine. Acetylcholine's action, its action on the postsynaptic nerve, exists as long as it exists in the acetylcholine form. So the acetylcholine esterase breaks it down into choline and acetate, and there are proteins on the presynaptic membrane that take it up to be recycled. So you've got that acetylcholine. And we'll see this a little later when we get to the specifics of acetylcholine, but that acetylcholine esterase is a unique target for certain neurotoxins that prevent its action. So the neurotoxins inhibit the acetylcholine esterase enzyme, inhibit number two, allowing acetylcholine to artificially rise in concentration. Having excess acetylcholine in that synaptic cleft has real trouble. Lots and lots of trouble. And it's a very potent if it's allowed to build up, it can kill you, and it will kill you. Many of the nerve gases that are produced nowadays attack that particular enzyme. Ever hear of sarin? S-A-R-I-N, sarin gas. Yeah, or VX. That's another nerve gas. Whenever it's a nerve gas, it's attacking acetylcholine. And several years ago, in the 80s, I think it was, there was a religious cult in Japan that, in some fit of insanity, synthesized and released sarin gas in the subways down there. And it injured hundreds of people and killed dozens in a terroristic attack in Japan. And that was because that sarin was inhaled, and immediately began to attack that acetylcholine esterase, blocked it from activity. The acetylcholine began to rise rapidly at the nerve-to-nerve junctions or nerve-to-muscle junctions, and people suffocated, and it was just really sad. Very, very sad. Very sad. All right, that's that handout. Next handout is, and you should have this in your possession right now, should have synaptic transmission and cellular signaling as the topic. Synaptic transmission and cellular signaling as the topic. Do you see that with you? Do you have that right there now? Okay. Again, you're going to see this, especially when we do acetylcholine, but synaptic transmission requires the following five steps, and these you should commit to memory. Synthesis is the required, then you have to store it, then you have to regulate the release of the neurotransmitter. So number three is actually the crucial, well, they're all three crucial. They are all, I mean, not all three, all five behaviors are all irreducibly fundamental. But number three, perhaps, is the most significant in terms of appropriate behavior, and that is the regulated release of neurotransmitter. It has to be released, it has to be regulated, and that whole process is a lifetime of study, if you wish it to be. Specific receptors for the neurotransmitter, and then termination of the neurotransmitter action. So you got to release it, and you got to terminate it. So synthesize it, store it, release it, make sure there are receptors for it, and then you got to terminate it. There's been a lot of materials that have been apparently thought to be neurotransmitters, but they could never figure out that they actually had any kind of response or any kind of receptor. So that's a problem. Now, we're going to look at some common terms here. Chemical transmission, a single action potential on a small presynaptic terminal can generate a large postsynaptic potential. Guess what letters you probably put in there? PSP. That is absolutely correct. Put in PSP, please. PSP. All right. So, put that in there then. Because, and what can happen is that the hundreds of thousands of neurotransmitters interact with that receptor molecule to open or close them about a millisecond. Resulting responses is either excitatory postsynaptic potentials or inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. What do you think that designation is? EPSPs, that's correct, or IPSPs, yeah. That's exactly correct. Now, here's a crucial understanding about the mechanism for most, but not all, most neurotransmitters. The release of the neurotransmitter takes place in quanta amounts or packets of multimolecular vesicles. We've seen that. So each of those little vesicles that you see clustered around the presynaptic synaptic cleft is considered to be a quanta. And we'll see that here in just a little bit. All right. Each packet represents a small postsynaptic, either miniature excitatory or miniature inhibitory. And you can see the abbreviations there. You need to be able to recall the abbreviations. When you have a specific neuromuscular junction, this is not nerve to nerve, but this is nerve to muscle. The neuromuscular junction is called the end plate. The PSP, MSPs are called EPPs. What do you think EPPs are? It's end plate potentials. Current measured, the voltage is held constant, and the current, if the current is measured, that is, the voltage is held constant and current measured, this is called voltage clamping. And the EPPs then are called EPCs, end plate currents. End plate currents. Here is the essence of what happens with vesicle-containing neurotransmission. Fast-acting chemical synapses accomplish this by concentrating neurotransmitter membrane-bound structures 50 nanometers in diameter, called synaptic vesicles, and docking these vesicles to specialized sites called active zones along the presynaptic site or membrane. Vesicles not docked to the membrane are clustered behind it and associated with cytoskeletal elements. The reason why they're associated with cytoskeletal elements is to keep them close to the synaptic cleft. Otherwise, they just wander away.
Wander away.
Can we see what I'm talking about here? Yes. Yes, you can see. This is page 2. All right. Notice here. Notice these cluster of vesicles immediately adjacent to this apparent cleft, synaptic cleft. Notice, if you would, how many of them there are. Notice, if you would, the universal size, the similar size of those vesicles. Now, would it make a difference if these vesicles were all kinds of different sizes? Would that be a problem that would have to be managed? If the vesicles were all different sizes? What kind of problems would that mean if they were all different sizes? Each time, because you wouldn't know which vesicle would be fused and released, and the amount of neurotransmitter would vary. Okay, so you know you couldn't tell. You'd be applauding like this, "Yay! I like it. It's very nice, very nice." Bam! What happened? Well, my sudden large neurotransmitter vesicle fused, not an average one. So that's that problem. Here you can see where it's a clustering and starting to fuse there. Ultrasonic structures of the synaptic vesicles. Boom, 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 boom. Et cetera, et cetera. Now notice here, if you would, look at C right here. This is C. After freezing, presynaptic vesicles were freeze-fractured and a platinum replica was made of external face of the cytoplasmic membrane leaflet. Vesicles fuse about 50 nanometers from rows of intramembranous particles throughout that are thought to include calcium channels. So here all these little dots are the fusing vesicles, and these larger dots that these holes that pierce through the membrane are thought to be the calcium channels. Calcium channels are extraordinarily important when you're dealing with vesicle release. All righty then. Page 3, ladies and gentlemen. Unfortunately, you have it in black and white. I have it in color. Aww. Oh, well, that's all right. Guess what this is? Now, you need to be able to... I like this diagram quite a bit. It's not my most favorite, but it's one of my favorite diagrams, especially dealing with this. And you need to be able to link the numbers here with the numbers in the figure and tell a story about the whole process of initiating and completing a neurotransmitter pulse, as it were. Life cycle, steps in the life cycle of synaptic vesicles. Woo! So, let's follow along, shall we? Number one says what? What is going on here? What's that XMTR stand for? That is a four-letter abbreviation for transmitter, or transmitter components. Number one, XMTR. Okay. See, that whole, you remember, well, never mind. Remember there used to be a radio, satellite radio service called XM? You know, first there was AM, then there was FM, now there's XM. Well, that's kind of a neat, but if you were a bit of a geek, you would realize that XMTR is a common abbreviation for like ham radio transmitter. And so it was kind of also a geeky response to that. All right, so the transmitter and or itself or transmitter components are come in, and then you get to make the transmitter. So the transmitter is sitting in the cytosol. Number two, what's it say here? The synthesis of the transmitter, et cetera. Step three, this vesicle, the vesicles, the newly formed vesicles are made at the cell body. Okay, made at the cell body. They are brought down empty along the axon to the synaptic bouton, as it were. Presynaptic bouton, which is French for button. Bouton. Notice it always sounds more sophisticated than English. Button. Bouton. Whatever. At any rate, so these things are empty when they come down. So literally, if you have a presynaptic, you need to make a little vesicle for your big toe, and the nerve is way back here. The cell body is way back here at the base of your spine. It's made and then transmitted along the entire length of the axon until it gets down to your nerve, tip of your nerve. Is that amazing or what? So what do you do now that you got the transmitter, you got your empty vesicle? What happens? Well, you start expending ATP. The vesicle comes empty, but it does have proteins with it. It's got some enzymes with it. One of the enzymes it has is an hydrogen ATPase, and what happens is it pumps hydrogens into the vesicle to acidify it slightly. Then along with that enzyme comes the transmitter enzyme, transmitter transporter, that's in the one of the membranes in the membrane of the vesicle. And with the motive force caused by excess hydrogen ion, there's an antiport in which the hydrogen ion is released, and then the transmitter is brought in. So it loads up the transmitter into the vesicle. Then the vesicle is moved along cytoplasmic elements and attaches temporarily to the surface of the inside surface of the membrane. It then waits. So here comes number 8. Guess what 8 represents? What is it? Action potential. The action potential comes along, and what happens to the calcium ionophores or the calcium transporters there? Opens up and the calcium rushes in. Why does the calcium rush in? What does that say about the relative concentration of calcium inside versus outside? It's 1,000 times more concentrated inside or 1,000 times more concentrated outside? Outside, right. It's about 1 millimolar outside, 1 micromolar in the cytoplasm of most cells. So there's a 1,000-point difference. This calcium can be thought of as being a secondary transporter. What small protein cassette does calcium bind to? Oops, someone said it. What was it? What is it? It is whenever the body wants to bind calcium for regulation or other things, it always uses the same protein to do that. Anybody remember what that protein is? Calmodulin. Yeah. Who said it? He did it. Why didn't you say it again? Bashful. Now, wait, are we not all friends here? Yes. Would we make fun of you if you said it completely wrong? Yes, we would. But it's a small price to pay for saying it. Be bold. If you've got to make a mistake, make a big one. But that wasn't a mistake. Anyway, all right, so the calmodulin comes in, calcium comes in, binds to some calmodulin-linked protein that initiates that trigger, allows the neurotransmitter to come in, And then there's a couple fates that happen here. So those neurotransmitters come, there's postsynaptic receptors along here, and they then are triggered positively or inhibitorily depending on the dendrite, and then you get the thing goes on. But what happens to the transmitter? Well, there's a couple different things that can happen to the transmitter. Let's see here. Number 11. Oh, I see. Now, number 11, the interesting thing is this process of releasing it out of a vesicle is quantized. In other words, you know how much is coming out. There are other neurotransmitter release that kind of leaks. It can just leak out on a low constant level. The body actually anticipates having that low constant level. So then the transmitter is right here. This transmitter actually is one of those leak things. Sometimes this is also a regulated release of transmitter through a protein as opposed to a vesicle. So there are a couple different ways that happens here. The fate of this is that either, see, you know, there can be degradative transmitter enzymes that break it down, or it can be brought back up. It can be reuptake is what it's called. Reuptake and brought back into the cell where it joins some sort of temporary membrane material, and the membrane is recycled as vesicles, and the transmitter is released into the cytoplasm where it's repumped in and so on. So you need to follow this. You're liable to see parts of this with pieces of it missing or the caption missing or whatever. You need to be thoroughly aware of that. All right. Now, this vesicle right here appears to be basically, it doesn't have a whole lot with it. It's got, according to this, it has at least a proton pump and a transmitter pump. But it turns out that that vesicle is full of protein signals. Full of protein signals. You look on page 4, page overhead 4. You see overhead 4? Yes, you do. This is a typical schematic representation of structure and topology of the major synaptic vesicle membrane proteins. Okay? N is amino and C is carboxy termini. Here's the table that relates to this. So, so here you go. Let's take a look. So you got a bunch of stuff right here. Let's see if we can figure out what it is. Let's start here at 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock. Now, 9 o'clock says proton pump. So what are you doing with this proton pump? What's it doing? Pumping protons into the lumen. That provides the lumen of the vesicle then becomes slightly acidic and allows then for that antiport uptake of the transmitter. And then over here you got this synapsin 1. Now, does it say down here what synapsin 1 is for? What's it say? Now, actin filaments. Now, actin filaments are a structure within the cell that provides anchors for all kinds of things. A lot of people think that the cell is mostly water. Well, there's a lot of water in it, but the cell is full of protein. If you have the nucleus right here. But there's just all kinds of layered cytoplasmic elements. Actin, other kinds of filaments. And these things provide internal structure to hold this stuff. So if this is the transsynaptic cleft, there could be all kinds of actin filaments right there that hold the vesicle at that region. So that actin filament is, and we don't have time to get into actin filaments. It's much more of a cell biology question, but actin filaments are structures, linear structures in the cell that provide scaffolding to which things can attach to and be moved. Now then, we got a calmodulin-dependent kinase. A calmodulin-dependent kinase. Kinase 2, whatever that means. I wonder what that means, calmodulin dependent. I wonder if that then uses calcium as a signal. Does it? Yes. Now, is that the only thing that can bind to calcium? No, you can bind to calcium a variety of other ways. But let's go on and take a look. At about 12:30, you got synaptotagmin. What's synaptotagmin about? Interaction with plasma membrane protein syntaxin and neurexin. These are for vesicle docking or fusion, coated vesicle adapter 2, and calcium. It's also a calcium sensor. So this is designed, that synaptotagmin is designed to interact with the plasma membrane syntaxin and neurexin. This is for docking or fusion. So this has to do with whether it's going to dock next to the synaptic cleft and whether it will fuse or not. Then you have synaptobrevin. And synaptobrevin, again, this is interaction with plasma membrane protein, syntaxin, or SNAP25. And we'll see what SNAP means in just a little bit. Again, this deals with vesicle docking or fusion. And then you get synaptophysin, which they don't really know too much about. Where is that? Synaptophysin? They think it might be a fusion pore. RAB3, which is also another regulatory protein in neurotransmission. You get SV2, some sort of transporter, other kinds of transporters. But you look here, and you see the vesicle, being, even though it's only 50 nanometers in diameter, has a tremendous package of proteins with it in order to be able to act as the way it does. Okay, so you need to be able to, especially the ones, the synapsin, the synaptotagmin, synaptobrevin, RAB3, in other words, the ones that don't have question marks after them, you need to give me a general idea of their function. Not necessarily the specific interactions, but synaptotagmin would be vesicle docking or fusion. Synaptobrevin, again, vesicle docking or fusion. Synapsin 1, vesicle cross-linking anchoring to actin filaments. You get the idea there. All right, so the vesicle then is just full of important things. So let's review again. This is on the previous page, page 3. We're looking at this again. We're saying that this is what happens at that presynaptic bouton as the vesicles come in. The vesicles come prepackaged with all these proteins, but they don't contain the neurotransmitter. They land in the bouton, the transmitter is uploaded, and then they begin to aggregate near the synaptic cleft. But if you look here, it looks like they're just plain with only maybe one protein. I'm not sure what that stick is. But that's incorrect. That vesicle right there is packed full of protein transporter goodness. That's listed right here. And probably this model is so old that this is actually not as accurate as it could be. And there are probably even more proteins associated with it than what's listed right here. So those vesicles right here is this. Now, do we know any more detail? This is kind of a static picture of what things are. Can we create a moving picture, as it were, of what's going on? And I think we can. Looking on page 5, overhead number 5, you see here where this is called the snare hypothesis. Snare. And we'll be talking about what snare is. V-snare, T-snare, SNAP, NSF, we are going to be going through this in detail with our next handout. All this stuff is cell biology, ladies and gentlemen, at least feels like it, but this is where the interface of the bio and the chemistry come in. Okay? This is where the bio and the chemistry come in. And so much of the research that we're doing in the United States is not so much a pure research, but it has typically some sort of a human, human medicine part to it. Even some very fundamental physical chemistry or analytical chemistry. Probably your professor is looking at where all the money is, and he's adapting his fundamental research to appeal to some sort of human medicine thing. And so you're liable to be dealing with some physical chemistry, even as you deal with some of these concepts and some of these things. I'm giving you this so that you can be well prepared when you get to graduate school. any rate, so here is the model, at least a very simple model. There are more elaborate models, but a very simple model of what's going on here. So they believe, here's the transport vesicle. They believe there is a protein or a cluster of proteins on the vesicle. They've called it V-snare, V for the vesicle. The snare, and the snare actually has a particular meaning. I'm not going to tell you what it is right now. But the V-snare interacts with another material called a T-snare. Now, the T-snare means target, the target snare. So these two proteins are designed to fit together when they're both activated. Well, right now, the T-snare is inactivated, has a protein called SEC1. SEC1 name, the names of these proteins, will vary depending on the species they're talking about. So this is probably, SEC1 deals with yeast. It's just, it can be a very confusing thing. But at any rate, so there is some signal that is initiated, probably a calcium-related signal. RAB, the GDP and RAB hydrolyzes, and you get GDP, you get the free SEC1 and inorganic phosphate that allows the V-snare and the T-snare to fuse. So that holds the vesicle next to the target membrane, but doesn't necessarily initiate fusion. This is where the SNAP and this NSF come in. When they are there together and physically close to this V-snare, T-snare grouping, that initiates an energy use that fuses the vesicle to the membrane and then releases the neurotransmitter. At the same time, the alpha SNAP and the NSF are released from that. Like I said, this model will make more sense, a little bit more sense, when we look at our next handout. But this is the model that we're going to go by: a V-snare, a T-snare, alpha SNAP, NSF, and then a fusion and release. Now, interestingly enough, there are some known toxins that are thought to attack, are known to attack these proteins on the synaptic vesicle. Why this particular book uses a shark to indicate an attack, I don't know. It has nothing to do with, this is not shark proteins or shark, what was that other stuff? Shark squalene or whatever it was, yeah. Don't ask me why. It was just the happy shark is going to be biting on some proteins. These happy sharks turn out to be botulism toxins. Oh, joy. Well, among my favorite diseases, of course, is botulism. My name's the Grim Reaper, okay? And botulism is a favorite disease, pardon me, of mine. Oh, brother. Along with cholera. I love cholera. Cholera is a great disease for harvesting a lot of human death and destruction. Fabulous. At any rate. So, tetanus interferes with synaptobrevin activity. Botulism toxins A, E, and C1 attack some of the synactin, these syntaxin proteins, prevent them from occurring, and these clostridial neurotoxins that inhibit neurotransmitter release, you get, this clostridial is a type of bacteria, very serious, botulism, tetanus. You ever seen the death throes in tetanus? Ever seen the death throes in tetanus? You can see that there are several paintings of people dying of tetanus during the Napoleonic Wars. And they would get... another name for tetanus, of course, is lockjaw. Lockjaw. And what happens is near the end... And I can't draw this very well because I don't draw things very well. But at any rate, the poor victims would, because the tetanus is altering the synaptic vesicle release. Their neuromuscular junctions are all told to come on at the same time. So both opposing muscles are turned on simultaneously. And so they're frozen. And when that happens with the entire body, their teeth is clenched and their entire body is like this. And they're frozen where only their head and their heels touch the ground. They're like this. And eventually it gets so bad that it freezes the diaphragm. They suffocate and that's how they die. You don't want to get tetanus. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you on Wednesday.